Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cinephiles Radio. I'm your host, Steve Pisa. Thank you so much for joining us today. We have the great Peter Jang on today. Writer, producer, director, stunt performer, stunt choreographer. All around great guy. Can't wait to talk to him. I have some new emails from people. You know, I was looking at the analytics of the people that we're reaching. United States is number one. I would assume so, of course. But yeah, the numbers are there. Germany is number two. That's strange to me, considering that Canada is number three. But Canada, do better. Come on. You're mighty because you're neighbor. Taiwan is next. And then United Kingdom. Well, thank you, Taiwan. I really appreciate that. I wonder how many people are learning English from listening to me. That's going to be sad. That's going to be a sad outcome. All right, Taiwan, I'll see you soon. Yeah, I've got a funny little story for you. I went to the market today. And I don't know how it came up. I think I was buying some ahi poke or something like that. Person behind the counter was Asian, just like I'm half Japanese, and we made some remark towards each other, and he goes, "Well, you don't look Japanese," and I'm like, "I don't know what to tell you, you know, what do you want me to do? Like, bring out some kind of like, you know, I'm Asian card, laminated? I don't understand." So it leads into another story. I remember when I was at the ripe age of 15 years old, and I was working at the AMC as just a little kid. And there was a circle of people standing around, from supervisors to cleanup crew to ticket busters, you know, the people who take your tickets. Now, I grew up with an immigrant background. My parents are immigrants. I grew up in an immigrant neighborhood. We were multifaceted, from being Filipino to, you know, European to Hawaiian. It just really was Hispanic. It was very scattered, but in a way it was we were all together in this game, right? So I know I'm naive in this when I say this, but I experienced more active racism than I did verbal racism. Like, at that time, you know, only white people played golf. You know what I mean? Only white people played tennis. And, like, when you watch Caddyshack, there's jokes. And then, you know, Arthur Ashe came in and changed the game. And then Tiger Woods came in and changed the game. Get back to the story. So, anyways, they're telling this racist joke. One of the guys is telling this racist joke. And I'm 15 years old. And I don't know what's happening. And everybody starts laughing. And I'm a little confused. I really don't get what he's trying to say. And this one guy, I see this clear as day, whitest skin you'll ever see, blonde, little blackish, slick all the way back, had canines that were quite sharp, actually, and blue eyes. He goes, "I take offense to that." And they all just stopped and looked at him, and he goes, and the guy who told the joke goes, why do you take offense at that joke? And he pulled out his wallet. And all of his family was black. Dark black, by the way. And he was the only white kid in his family. He was an Aboriginal. He was, you know, some kind of fluke, is what he would say. Now, I really don't know what his story is, and we didn't really get into it. And like I said, I was 15 years old, so, you know, the story can only be as true as I've been telling it for the past, you know, upteenth years. But everybody looked extremely shocked, and everybody scattered like roaches. Like roaches. Now, what that really taught me was you really don't have any idea at any time who you're talking to. So if you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything at all. And if a conversation starts off as, you know, I'm not racist, but, yeah, something bad is about to happen. But I just woke up with that story in my brain. And, you know, a lot of, you know, neurologists and a lot of, you know, motivational speakers and what have you say, like, you're only going to remember your 10th birthday like 19 times in your entire life. Well, I remember this story, and I've taught this to my students hundreds of times. Just because you just don't know who you're talking to, you don't know what they're going through. So one text, one day, can mean one thing, and another text in 2 weeks can mean a completely different thing. So sometimes intent goes into play. Well, enough of me jibber-jabbering. Let's bring on the great Peter Jang. Let's give him a little clap as he comes on in here.
Hi there, how you doing?
Hey, Peter. That's the way everybody wants to enter the room, right? With big claps.
Yeah, right. Or a lot. That's like a clap track. I love that. Me, can you share that around with me?
It goes back to Three's Company or what have you.
Yeah.
Now we haven't seen each other in it. Good. I'm doing very good. We had some technical difficulties, obviously, and I had to communicate with that with you. Well, the reality of the situation is I have one of these middle MacBook Pros, one where they took away a lot of the extensions like the SD card and what have you. So I need to use this little adapter in order to plug in all of my equipment. Yeah. And then I just lost it. So it's like, oh my God.
I'm a PC guy myself, so I can't relate too much.
Yeah. I've been a PC guy my entire existence. I only got into MacBook Pros maybe around 5 years ago, 6 years ago. But yeah, I've been a PC builder since I was a little boy. So, and before that, I was a Commodore. Yeah, my brothers and I were all programmers for the Commodore 64 and what have you. So I built my own PCs. I'm a big gamer. I mean, I only game on a PC, obviously. You know, and I love, you know, you can't play video games on a Mac.
Well, I imagine if you wanted to, it'd cost you $1 million just to get the rig.
Yeah, well, the problem with Macs is that you'd have to get a code or a program that actually makes it into a PC, and then you can dummy the program from that point on. So it's like, whatever, dude, you might just buy a PC. You know, they're only, you know, a fraction of the price. I'm on a gaming computer, it's a fraction of the price of a MacBook Pro. A MacBook Pro will cost you around $1,400, where a decent rig will cost you around $900.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, as a budget filmmaker, I have to go with the PC
I agree with you. Well, the Adobe Premiere, and the way to get Adobe Premiere on there is so fantastic. And, you know, as well as getting, you know, I'm going to be honest, pirated copies and what have you. I took, you know, Adobe came out to my college and spoke to us when we were doing class in Photoshop. And one of the questions was, should you pirate Adobe? Because it was the big days of pirating, especially for college students. Right. And yeah, the representative said, listen, ethically speaking, if you're not making any money off of our program, I can completely understand why you're pirating our program. But if you're making money off of our product, you 100% should pay for it.
Right.
You know?
Well, I think it makes it a lot easier too, because now you can do the subscription. So
yeah,
that's what I've been doing.
Yeah. Well, they've been very intelligent about that, because you could end your subscription like $30 a month and just, you know, take a break and then come back to it and what have you. And there's so many programs you can get for free just to practice along the way. Or now we have YouTube and what have you. So you can learn from like a 14-year-old how to edit and what have you. But it's been a very long time since we actually seen each other. The last time we saw each other was at the premiere of our short films at the Chinese Theater. And that was like literally hours before the pandemic hit.
Right. Yeah. Grauman's Chinese Theater. That was right. That must have been at least a year and a half, 2 years ago?
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Yeah,
well,
my short film Ponds. I had that film out there. I think you had your zombie film out, right?
Yeah, I had my zombie film out there, and I was able to see Ponds as well, which was excellent. You know, no surprise, of course, but I was very happy to see you there. I was surprised because we seemed to bump into each other all over the place, like the tours, awards, and we know a lot of the same people, you know, going to Bat in the Sun and Truly in these studios and Aaron Shankey to Sean Piccinino and what have you. So we know the same people, but it's always great to bump into you.
Yeah. Well, I've been in the industry for about 11 years. And I've noticed that, there a lot of people want to be in the industry, but then like everybody kind of burns out after a couple of years. So, if you've been in it long enough, then it does become a pretty small world just because there's only a few of us that actually stay in it.
Right. Now, why do you think people, before we go on to your This Is Your Life moment, why do you think that it is that people burn out on this? Is it like one of those I don't have any hope moments, or what is it?
Well, I actually talked to a lot of people about this because, I think that to be in the film industry in general, like I know this about myself very specifically, that you have to be a little bit, let's say, eccentric, in a certain way, because we're all deciding, to make a career out of something that, at a very young age, a lot of people are like, I have to get a real job, So, like we're all a little bit crazy to do this whole freelance, make art as a living kind of choice for ourselves. And all practicality, it makes a lot of sense to me. I even tell people, I've taught a few seminars here and there about either filmmaking or stunts or anything like that. I basically tell people, first off, let me tell you, probably shouldn't do it. And second off, if you do decide to do it, you have to really figure out if you really love this, because the worst case or the best case scenario is that you don't find work if you don't love it, is what I mean. Is
right.
That you don't find work in like 2 or 3 years. And then you burn out, you do something else, and you move on. The worst case scenario is that you do find a little bit of work. And then, 7, 10 years down the line, and then maybe work dries up, or you have like a little dry spell and you don't like what you do, and you're also really short on money, and it doesn't feed you at all, like artistically, or it doesn't feed your soul at all. Then you're not only are you going to have to find something else to do, but you're also going to be starting from the bottom, because, for the most part, people who don't really see this as like a quote unquote real career. So, 17 years into it, all of a sudden you've been basically unemployed for the last 7, 10 years.
Right.
And you have to go back to entry level kind of positions, no matter how good you were at whatever you were doing beforehand. So, I mean, for all practicality, it makes a lot of sense to me that people do, kind of burn out, or, maybe they thought that they wanted to do it, but then once they saw the world and once they started doing it for a couple of years, there's like, this isn't for me. And I think that's very healthy, but I usually see it around like 2, 3 years of doing it. Usually people kind of figure out whether or not it is something that really feeds them, not just, money wise, but also feeds their soul and makes them want to do this, because it's not an easy route to go.
Right.
The freelance lifestyle in general is just very difficult.
It sounds almost like you're implying that, like a quick, it sounds like it's a negative thing, that a natural buildup to your career would be more of a preferable route.
Well, I think it depends. If it just so happens that you're right and this is something that you love to do, and I always say, like, would you do this if you weren't being paid?
Right.
If it is something that you could do sustainably for a long time, and like I said, it has to feed your soul. It can't just be something that you're doing for money, because, for the most part, most people have a really hard time making a living at it. And if you do, it's a relatively modest living. There's very few people in the film industry, except for the ones at the top that are doing like these big things that are making a huge, huge killing, So I don't know. I feel like, if you found it early on and you found success and it's something that you really love to do and it's something that really feeds your soul, then yeah, I think it's great that you can find success early on, whether you're a journeyman or not. But if you know, if you do find success early, but it's not something you love to do, it's just something that, you know, is fun in, at the moment, but then 10 years later, you're lost in your life, then I don't know if it was really worth it.
Right, right. And how did you find your experience? I mean, you're brought up in Ohio, right?
Yeah, I am from Columbus, Ohio. I grew up in Delaware, Ohio, kind of out in the farmlands. I live on a farm, but, you know, driving to high school is about, you know, 15, 20 minutes straight of, like, farmlands. But, yeah, I wanted to go into business. I came out to San Diego, UC San Diego, University of California at San Diego, economics.
This is like, before you start talking about that, my question is about that is, was it the UC San Diego where you get drunk at, or was it the UC San Diego? Because we both know the two San Diego colleges there. One is where the party college, and the other one is like
San Diego college. Yeah, San Diego State, the party college.
Yeah.
They do have a good business program, though.
Yeah. I'm sure they do. Well, business people really know how to party. I'm telling you. But you went over there. You said you went over there for economics.
Right, right. Yeah, so I did more of the egghead side of it. they like to say that UC San Diego, it's University of California, San Diego, but we called it UC Socially Dead. it was a fun school. I have to say I didn't do my fair share of partying there, but there's no fraternity row. There's not like these huge like mansion parties that you got in a lot of other schools, you know, like at fraternity houses and stuff. And
right.
Our mascot, you know, on our thing, it's the Triton, but like if you look at the logo of UC San Diego, it's the library. It's Geigel Library.
Right.
It's named after
right.
Geigel and Dr. Seuss. Even when we were, you know, doing anything on campus, a lot of times it would be sitting around the library and, you know, it was a more serious school. A lot of people are just studying a lot, you know, sports. I was a college athlete. I fought Taekwondo in college. I was on the college team, but, I think the highest scholarship they gave when I was there was like a $500 scholarship, which would barely pay for the books. So
yeah.
they didn't care that much.
That's like
about
dinner.
You know, sports where they're actually paying people to be there. You know?
Yeah. Well, you started off in Ohio in Taekwondo, right? How old were you?
I did. I first started off with karate when I was very young. I was actually talking to my father about this the other day. He just moved out here to California.
Oh, nice.
But, yeah, I was doing karate only for a couple of months. It didn't take, and then moved on. And then a friend of his was my first kung fu teacher when I was 8 years old, and then I moved to a different school. And so I did kung fu for, I would say, probably about 4 years, and then I moved on to Taekwondo just because Kung Fu, as great as it is, it didn't have the kind of structure that that Taekwondo has as far as having an Olympic event. So my father decided that because Taekwondo is in the Olympics, and there's a path that you can go. And versus Kung Fu is kind of like segmented. Everybody's like, you know, the praying mantis styles don't think that the Hungar styles aren't as good. And,
right.
And
seven star
like
praying mantis and Hungar and Hopgar. Yeah.
All of them, they think they're the best, you know, versus Taekwondo, there's a strict curriculum and, you know, you do this form with this belt and you fight these people, you know, a little bit more organized than that.
Well, I don't really speak about myself. You know, this is like my 157th episode of this program. And I never speak about myself, but I've been teaching Kung Fu since I was 17 years old, and I had two dojos myself. Mm-hmm. What's very interesting about martial arts is that in the end of the round, because I know that you performed kata and or forms or patterns in college. What's interesting about martial arts is in the very end, it's all noodles. It's all noodles.
Right.
Yeah, it's spaghetti, it's noodles. It's just what it is. Because you can say you're the best at what you do, and it's really not true. It's the person who's the most passionate. It's the person who sees the most in themselves and in what they're doing. But these people that say that their style, Hopgar, Hungar, Seven Star Praying Mantis, to Shaolin Kung Fu, to... you know, White Crane, to even like things like White Snake in San Diego and what have you, or White Tiger. These people who say that, and we also have the Pogiwons, Cholgiwons, Sangmukwans in Korea and what have you, before General Cho made it all into Taekwondo, or Shibogis, or even Okinawa Tae going into karate as well. We're not going to talk about this all day long, but when you look at those styles, a lot of those people will say, you know, we're the best at what we do. But I would argue that's a lot of people who would say I have the highest IQ. It's like, what? Like that? I mean, Einstein and Stephen Hawking would say, like, anybody who compares IQ is an idiot. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. I'm the same way, you know. And growing up, my father was very adamant, what he called cross-training. And, you know, for me, going to these schools, and they're like, no, you should not go to that other school. This is the school that you should be at. And then, you know, but father at home telling me, well, no, you take the best teachings from boxing, the best teachings from wrestling, the best teachings from Taekwondo, the best teachings from Kung Fu, and, you know, all the different styles, you know, find all of them that you like and find their best teachings and then cut out the stuff that you don't like and then make your own thing. And you know, he was a very entrepreneurial man. You know, he came over here, you know, in college and started his own business. So I can see how he kind of took that for his own life, and then he passed that on to me. I think that was one of the best things I ever figured out for myself, that he ever gave me, that, you know, I helped make for myself, was that taking all the best things from everything and, you know, putting it all into my own experience, and then finding how to, you know, what is the best way that makes me healthier and also makes it so I can protect myself and also makes it so that I can pursue, you know, better things moving forward. You know, I think it also helped me with fight choreography as well, because, you know, whenever I am putting together some kind of fight, then I'm not really married to one kind of style, even though unless it's supposed to be stylized, you know, I can kind of draw from all these different things, and it gives a lot of great ideas, because sometimes with certain martial arts, it can be very limiting, and they're like, never do this movement, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for me to think that way.
Right. Well, I think there's a difference between a professional martial artist that's, you know, going to stay inside of a brick and mortar for the rest of their lives. You know, they're going to teach in a dojo for the rest of their existence. And somebody who's meant to go out there and perform and be their own person and like a stunt choreographer or a stunt performer, or what have you. I think the versatility, I believe, would do you justice, because, like you said before, you know, unless you're going to be a Jackie Chan, you or a Jet Li, you need to represent all styles. You need to know what you're going to do in different ways and adapt.
Sure. Well, you know, and I think obviously I would never say that they shouldn't be experts in certain things, you know. I mean,
that's not what we're saying.
People that dedicate, with somebody that dedicates their entire life to a specific kind of art, I mean, I think that's a beautiful thing as well. I think that, you know, personally, we should all be open to everything. But, you know, if there was never anybody that was an expert in anything, though, then we wouldn't be able to draw from all these different things, because there would be no pure form of it out there. So, I think that, you know, seeing people that dedicate their entire life to a specific art, I think it's beautiful. I really do. But I just know that for myself, I want to be able to move forward into the future, like, taking the best from all these different things and then combining them together. I think it maybe is just maybe because I'm a mixed race person, you know. I felt maybe that's kind of what happens when people get together.
I 100% understand where you're coming from. I remember, you know, I'm one of the fourth youngest grandmasters of my style's history, and I remember one of my family members in Fukushima, Japan, said to me, like, why don't you teach a karate do? And I go, why don't I cook Chinese food? Well, I mean, are you kidding me? It's not, you know, before World War II, karate do meant China Han Wei. After World War II, karate do meant empty Han Wei. So it's like, just everybody calm down. Everybody calm down. It's, you know what I mean? It's all, because I'm half Japanese, half Sicilian. So it's like, you know, you mixed in, and I'm as well. And you know, you look more Asian than I do, so people don't question your Asian passport. But people absolutely,
Depends on who you are.
No. Yeah. Well, maybe you, so some people you look more Native American or Latino. People get that mixed all the time. But I would argue if you look at the classic samurai that have beards and what have you, they look Hispanic as heck.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a long time ago, you know, the Bering Strait, you know, was connected between Russia and in Alaska. So
That's a lot
of the Native Americans, you know, they have Asian lineage. And even when I did my 23andMe a long time ago, you know, they actually mixed in a lot of the Native American with Asian heritage, just because as far as DNA goes, I mean, they are very similar, just because that's who walked over. I mean, that's where Native Americans came from. They walked over from Asia.
That's right. One of my favorite subjects is history, as well as archaeological studies. And in California, the oldest arrowhead we found inside of a cave was a Japanese arrow. It's the oldest arrow we found in America. And it was a time where the black bear was the size of an 18-wheeler. And it's really amazing how time, right? That would scare the hell out of me. I don't care who you are. I mean, those guys were like 4'10". Like I would literally go like, go ahead.
Those things are
ferocious. Yeah, I know. They're ferocious. Yeah. They're ferocious at like 5 feet long, much less like, you know, the size of an 18-wheeler. Like I'd be like, what am I doing in this state? Like, I'm get me out of this country. Those guys fought those guys. It was incredible.
And those are the ones that can climb up trees too, I think, right? Like you can't even escape them if you. Like a grizzly can climb up the tree and get away from it, but a black bear will just climb up right after you.
I think those guys would just swipe the tree down and knock you off and then eat you, because they're so gigantic. You know, the one thing, and I wanted to ask you before we move on, as we were talking about kata and you doing that in college, what was your favorite kata pattern or form?
The longest time I really enjoyed my kung fu forms the most. You know, I know that's not the same as taekwondo, but yeah, I know you were maybe asking me about taekwondo because that's what I was doing in college. But my kung fu forms were, you know, I mean, it's just artistry in motion, and taekwondo is the same thing. It's just it's much more regimented. You know, it's a little bit more strong. You know, it's not as flowy, but you know. For taekwondo, I mean, my main thing was actually sparring. Like, I spent all of my time training sparring. I did very well in my forms competitions, and Koryo is the first-degree black belt form that I did.
Ah, Koryo Punse, yeah.
I loved it. You know, I love that form still. But at the same time, it's my main focus, you know, through my taekwondo career was actually sparring, even though that I did better in my forms competition than sparring. Because, you know, I did get national champion one time for sparring, but four times for forms competition. So I was better with forms. Maybe I looked pretty good while I do them. But my main focus throughout my taekwondo career was always about sparring, just because I always felt that the greatest test, obviously, other than just straight up fighting, you know. I think that, you know, putting yourself in competition is a very great test of your mental toughness, and then also just showing how well you do with another person and, on a spur of the moment, but like, you know, something that you prepare and then you have to prove it in the ring. You know, I like that side of it, you know, having that kind of gladiator kind of feeling of going into the ring, knowing that you and him have trained to the peak, you're paired up because you guys are the same, you know, same height or whatever, and then you just see who's best that day. I love that, and that's what I trained for. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned choreo. I actually did a dissertation on the kata choreo, you know, where it came from. It actually originated in China, went off to Korea, and then went off to Okinawa and then Japan. And a lot of people call, you know, the Korean style and the Japanese style Koryo 2. And they call the original one Koryo. Because for the listeners out there, there was the Koryo dynasty in Korea. So the Koryu dynasty is what Koryu was named after. But it's a really beautiful, beautiful form. It's actually one of my favorite katas or forms. And what's interesting about katas out there that are listening that don't understand, inside your kata, there's called bunkai. And bunkai is a Japanese word for what is the translation of movement. What does this move mean? Because it's not just you're not just dancing. These movements should have application. They should have meaning. So if you type in, you know, B-U-N-K-A-I in YouTube, you'll find a lot of people going like, this is, and by the way, it's up to interpretation. This is what this means. This is what this means and what have you. So it's very interesting to hear you. I mean, this is a very interesting conversation. I haven't had this conversation in a very long time, but let's go back to your movie career. So you're in Ohio. You go, right, we're all over the place, right? You go off to from Ohio to San Diego State. When in between these moments did you decide
UC San Diego, not San Diego State.
Oh, excuse me. Let's not get those confused, right? So UC San Diego. So you go to UC San Diego. When is it between this moment that you decide, hey, listen, I want to get into the entertainment industry. I want to do this.
Well, you know, it was actually much after that. Once I went to UC San Diego, I finished my degree in economics, and I got a job down there in San Diego. Then I moved up and got a job up here as a business development specialist in a market research firm in Santa Monica. But when I was still in San Diego, though, I did do one day of extra just for fun. Just somebody, one of my friends had posted up something on his Facebook saying that they were looking for somebody. I was like, oh, that'd be fun. So I did it, and it was a really, really cool time. And then when I moved up to L.A. to work at that market research firm, I started doing extra work here, too, just for fun. You know, I liked being on set. I didn't really care about the money because it wasn't much. It was like $8 an hour or something like that. It was fun. I got to be on set. I got to see how the sausage was made. And that was really my introduction to the film industry. But then once I got into SAG, I was actually on the Muppets movie and the movie In Time. I got all my SAG vouchers. So for people listening, to join SAG, you can get 3 vouchers as a union extra person, and you can join the union. I got all of mine on the movie In Time and the Muppets movie. I saw like, oh, I can make $18 an hour doing this. And at the job I was at, I was only making $16 an hour. I was like, huh.
That's an easy salary.
Yeah, and I basically went to the people because I liked that job. I actually really liked that job. And I was just like, hey, I have this opportunity to do extra work. I mean, it's $18 an hour. If you guys can match that, I'll stay. But if not, then I'm going to go. And they basically was like, well, we'll do $17 an hour. I was like, all right, well, bye. And, of course, they did the whole song and dance of like, yeah, you'll never make it. What are you? You're making the biggest mistake of your life, whatever. But,
right.
Yeah, I think it worked out pretty good. So when I first came here, I was at a market research firm. And then, just doing extra work, meeting people on set. It was just a lot of fun. And then once I started working a little while and, I was doing that for a bit when I was making a decent amount of money, actually. And then, but then people kept on telling me, like, oh, well, you're a martial artist. You're just looking at stunts. So I started asking around, and there was a answering service called Missy's that basically before there were cell phones and you could leave voicemails very easily and get a hold of people, they had all these stunt people would use something called an answering service where they would know the schedule of those stunt people. So if they were on set or were doing whatever they were doing, people could still book them without having to worry about, them not being able to take the job. So
right.
I didn't have anything like that, but like she kind of took me under, she was, her name was Missy. She's passed away since then, unfortunately, but she kind of got me, was sending me on something called Hustles, where basically you go to a set and you meet the stunt, you try to find the stunt coordinator and give them your resume and tell them you want to get hired. She sent me on some of those, and eventually one on the CSI New York, my now good friend Norman Howell, he's a stunt coordinator on that. He asked her, he's like, hey, I want somebody a little bit more green. He really likes giving people chances, new people chances. And he knew that the job that didn't require like a super crazy amount. So he wanted somebody that like wanted to be in the business and that he could kind of help out. So she gave him my name, and that ended up being my first full-rate stunt job on CSI New York. And it's pretty simple. I just, played a bodega's owner's son, and I got knocked right over into some boxes.
CSI New York was your first real job, right? Your first big job.
Yeah, my first full-rate stunt job, right? Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, I did other movies and projects, it's like $100 here or free. I think at that point I had done a Lupe Fiasco music video. That was actually a big kick for me, just because he was one of my favorite rap. He was my favorite, rapper at that time. He was my favorite like music artist at the time. And, I loved his music. And then all of a sudden I'm on set with him fighting him. I was like, this is pretty freaking cool. Yeah,
I hope I don't hit him in the face.
Right. I remember when, he came over and he came to all the guys there and he's just like, hey, so you guys have any ideas? And I just jumped up, my hand up to him. I was like, yeah, I have an idea. So I was the first one to come out and fight him. So it was like a sequence of like 10 people. And then because I just like took the initiative, I was like, hey, I got ideas. I'm going to do something. I was like super excited to be there.
Right.
Yeah, I ended up being the first one on there. And I think I was the most visible in the music video too.
Well, squeaky wheel gets the grease, I see.
Yeah, I guess so. finding myself into the stunt industry just kind of happened organically. Once I started working the first time, and I'm a pretty diligent guy. I'm very reliable. I don't lie about the skills that I have, and everything like that. And I just kept on training and everything like that. I started gaining a reputation for being reliable. And I think also since I have a very specific kind of look, since I'm mixed race. There were a couple of different times when there just wasn't anybody else that was A, available, or B, that looked similar to my height, build, and look.
Right.
So especially when a really big particular break, two big particular breaks that I had was one, I booked a role on a show called The Originals, where I played the brother of one of the main villains in one of the episodes.
Yeah, I love the show.
Series of episodes. Yeah, and that was pretty big because they flew me out to Atlanta and they put me up for like a month or two where we were just filming these episodes. And that kind of ingratiated me with a decent amount of people who were working out there and gave me a little bit of clout. And then later on, when Daniel Henney joined the cast of Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, and I had done one day of doubling him on the show Revolution for Jeff Wolf in Texas, but because of that, I talked to the stunt coordinator Greg Barnett on Criminal Minds Beyond Borders when that started up. And I was like, hey, I told him, I was like, hey, I have doubled him before. If you have somebody, I'd love to be an alternate. Thinking that because I was still relatively new and I didn't want to step on anybody's toes. But then he's like, I don't have a double for him. You're him now. and I was with him for 2 years, 2 seasons. And he also, he gave me my first, fight coordinator credit. And, I got to choreograph, a big episode of the fight scenes in the big episode, of the second season. As I kept on going, I started gaining more and more exposure and started meeting better and better people, not better people, but like higher people in the industry. And, just building that reputation of being A, honest, and B, reliable, I think it really helped me, throughout my career.
And you worked on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is a big show. It's a gigantic show. Is that the part where,
Yeah, no, yeah. That funny thing about that actually is, I got that from an email. I emailed the stunt coordinator maybe like the week before I got that first time I worked on it, and I was like, hey, I would love to work on the show, whatever. And then he said, I think within like a day, he email me back. It's like, hey, well, you're hired. Do you want to come next week? And I was like, yeah, that sounds awesome. And then I get on the set and I talk to the people on there. And he's like, he never does that. How did you get this? Like, he never does that. It's crazy. I was like, I don't know. I guess I just got lucky.
Well, no, I don't really believe in luck. I don't want to go too far into this conversation before I ask this, because you're obviously alluding to it. But, you know, when you think about it, and I know you've said many things about this, but when you think about it, what is it about you that makes people want to spend 10, 12, 16, 18 hours with you or send an email like this? I know you said it was about reliability and consistency and what have you, but there's got to be another, what you would call a je ne sais quoi, a quality that is kind of almost, you know, unimaginable, or you really can't articulate, but I'm pretty sure you can.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think underlying it, all of it has to be the reliability and everything like that, because your reputation is everything in Hollywood, obviously. But as far as myself, you know, I do try to be very supportive of people, and I try to, you know, go out of my way to let people know that I like them, you know. So I think that most people, they respond to that. I mean, and being cool on set is going to be really important for anybody, just because you can be the best in the world at something, but you're not going to be the best in the world at it for the rest of your life. And so
right.
If you're a total jerk to everybody, then, you know, once you're not the best
right.
anymore, then, you know, they really don't have a lot of incentive to use you. Not to mention, you know, this is movies. This isn't reality. So it's not like you have to go in and actually defeat, you know, the Balrog or something like that. You just have to
right.
pretend to do so. So, I mean, really, those kind of jobs, you know, obviously there are those jobs that only one person can do in the world. But for the most part, especially for film, I mean, with camera angles and being able to cheat certain things and special effects, I mean, really, as you just have to be like, I think, you know, one of the, I can't remember her name, the lady from Shark Tank. One of the ladies from Shark Tank said that it's like 80% is good enough, right? In business, 80% is good enough, because that last 20%, the you know, the pursuit might not be worth what you gain from it. Happens a lot with a lot of things in film. Maybe not, obviously not certain jobs, but for a lot of things in film, just because as long as you're competent at your job, you can get it done. It looks like pretty good, and you're easy to work with, you're going to go far, just because, you know, not every job is going to be those kind of jobs that you have to be that one person in the entire world that can do that thing. You know, I mean, if you're falling down, there's a lot of people that can fall down, and there's a lot of people that can make it look good. Now, they're not going to just go with, you know, they're not going to just go with anybody though. So if knowing that a lot of people can do a certain job, then they're obviously going to go with the person that they know is going to show up on time, is going to not bother everybody on set with being a diva, and isn't going to like share a bunch of secrets about the show that people don't want you to show. And also that they're just going to be overall like happy, that people are going to be happy to be working with them, you know, like then and also in the future.
Right. I think we've known each other for, I mean, I don't know, quite a long time. And the one thing that I've always known about you is you've never been overly excited. You know, whenever I meet you or talk to you, you don't seem overly excited. You just seem like, you know, you're cool, relaxed, you know. And I, you do, you know what I mean? It's, you know, very, very casual, just like, hey, how's it going? You know. You're not like a dancing puppy or anything like that, you know, and a lot of people have a tendency to be that, you know, in the entertainment industry, you're always pretty cool.
I think sometimes I've gotten in my way though, to be honest, because, you know, a lot of people, they do feed off of energy like that. But, you know, even
right.
when I was younger and I was doing these national competitions, you know, and stuff like that, my father would always look at me and he's like, you're not nervous or anything. I'm like, and obviously I was nervous and I was excited, but like, something about me, when I get into a high stress situation or a high excitement situation, I calm down. I become cool as a cucumber, and I analyze everything, and I take it in. You know, I mean, I think you see me sometimes, and it might seem like I'm very calm and, like, you know, collected, but, you know, inside
right.
I am, and my mind's going a million miles an hour, and I am super excited. It's just,
right.
for me, my initial reaction to those kind of situations is just
right.
to get into myself, figure out what I'm doing, keep my mind about myself, and then make sure that I'm ready to go whenever a dime hits, whenever you know, the gun goes
right.
off or something. So.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with our martial art experience. You know, for me, when we were at the Chinese Grams Theater, I remember our film got Best Horror Film, and I was talking to a director
mm-hmm.
at that time, and they're calling me up there. I'm like, time may just go up. I'm talking to a director right now. Like, I don't get overly excited. You know what I mean? It's like nothing really satisfies me to a certain extent because, you know, martial arts and Buddhism in life is really about, quelling your expectations and just the pursuit is, and the journey is really the reward more than the, you know, getting so excited at the moment, especially with you martial arts. I mean, if you get so excited in the moment, you can't make that blow. You can't make that kata work. You can't make that movement. Your energy needs to be consistent.
Yeah, and I clearly agree. I mean, I think that my personality and just my outlook in life and how I react to a lot of things is very much comes from my ground and just the way of life that I've chosen to live. I mean, ever since I started martial arts, I've just I decided that this is the way that I want to live my life. I don't want to, the martial artist mindset of just, you know, constant improvement and always the pursuit of not perfection, but like pursuit of it, you know, I think is worthy. And,
right.
Yeah. I mean, I love that way of life because it makes me feel very happy with whatever happens.
Right.
You know, whether it's good or bad or neutral, I'm just happy to live there in the present and be experiencing it.
I had some of my favorite stunt choreographers, stunt performers, from Haley to Amy to a lot of these really great people, really do thank their martial art background that have made them who they are today. And you can see it in the way mm-hmm. they perform and the way they act and the way they talk and the way they perceive information. So it's an incredible thing. So when I look at your resume and when I look at the things that you've done, it's pretty large and it's pretty, consistently wildly high. But I want to talk about Criminal Minds because I'm a huge fan of Criminal Minds. How did that come mm-hmm. along and how did that work out for you on that show?
Well, I first started off on Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. I think I told you about that just now, with Daniel
yeah.
Henney joined the cast. And
that's
because
right.
he's half Korean and I don't know, when we were on set together, you know, people would confuse me for him all the time because, you know, when we're all done up and wearing the same clothes, I mean, we have a similar skin complexion. We have similar, similar build. And he's a little bit taller and skinnier than me. But, I mean, for the most part, especially from far away, you can't tell at all, which is it was perfect. I was a perfect double for him.
Right.
So I did that for 2 years. And then once Criminal Minds Beyond Borders got canceled, I contacted the stunt coordinator for Criminal Minds. And I told him, I was like, hey, I was Daniel's stunt double on Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. I know he's moving over to the flagship. So if you don't have somebody for him already, I would love to, keep doing it. And, he brought me on and, that was that. I mean, and then for another 3 seasons of Criminal Minds, I was his double. It was a much larger cast and, so he wasn't doing as much, but, every couple of episodes I was coming on and I got to hang out with Daniel. He's a really, really great guy. And then also just that particular show had been going on for so many seasons at that point, they were all family. So it was really cool going in there and seeing, when you go on a show that has only been there for about, maybe it's the first season or second season. A lot of times it's a little bit chaotic just because everybody had just gotten together so that, They don't really know. They know each other, and they maybe have worked on things before, but they're still getting used to that show particularly.
Right.
But then once you get past, like, you know, fifth season, sixth season, seventh season, you know, and I think at Criminal Minds, wasn't that like the 13th or 14th season? I don't know. It was pretty far. they had it down to a well-oiled machine. I mean, like, you know, first season of shows, you know, you can go out and be there for, like, you know, 12, 13 hours a day. But then on these kind of shows like Criminal Minds, I mean, you know, 7.5 hours, you're out. You know, they have it down like a well-oiled machine. They know when to bring you in, when to get you out. And, you know, you're not – if they're not searching for a lot of things, they're maybe like, this, we know what we're doing, and it's a well-oiled machine. So it was really cool to be on that set. And I'm really happy that it worked out that Daniel moved over.
Well, I don't think a lot of people have this experience of, you know, being – not involved in a show and then going to a show that pretty much establishes itself as a family, like in Criminal Minds. And you were just talking about that a couple of seconds ago. What are the feelings when you go into a show like that? Is it happiness? Is it a little fear? What's your interpretation of that?
Oh, well, I mean, for me, I'm just happy no matter what set I'm at, even if it's a small set. I just enjoy the process in general. So maybe I'm a bad person to ask that question, just because for me, it's whatever set I'm going to, whether it's a big show or a small show or whatever, I kind of come into it with the same mindset. There have been a few shows that I actually like watch pretty consistently that I've worked on, but very few. I mean, for the most part, there's so much content out there that, you know, it's really impossible to watch every show, like, as a huge fan. So, and a lot of these shows that I'm on are, you know, are the police procedurals, kind of like Criminal Minds or and stuff like that. So, you know, one season could have 23 episodes. It's a lot of TV. So I can't be a fan of all of the stuff that I worked on. But, you know, when I come on to a set, even if it is something that I was a big fan of, like when I worked on The Punisher, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the Netflix Punisher series. You know, it was definitely surreal, but I still went into it the same way as I did any other job. I was there, you know, to do something in particular. I try to compartmentalize a little bit. Like, I'll keep my giddiness, you know, down into, I'll feel it the next day or something like that. Like, I can't believe I just worked on that. But on the day, though, I try my best to just kind of put that aside and be like, look, all these people, they're trying to do their job. I'm doing my job. And especially with stunts, because there is so much safety involved. I don't have the luxury to be starstruck or anything like that, because I have to worry about this other guy hitting his head, or I have to worry about myself not hurting this other person. You know, I mean, even when, and they kind of, I don't know, this is a little bit, maybe a bit of an offshoot. This is the way I always tell like my actors when I'm doubling them, because a lot of actors, you know, and rightfully so, they want to do some of their own stunts because, you know, they want to be in the character. But for me, I was like, well, look, and, you know, you don't have to worry about the lines. You have to worry about the emotions. You have to worry about the story and all these different things. I mean, I have to worry about those to a certain degree, but those aren't not to the same amount that you are. Now, you're not making your own clothes. You're not cooking your own food. So, you know, you don't need to do all of your own stunts, especially the really dangerous ones, because if you're in character and you're fighting this guy, you're trying to kill him, versus if I come in there, I'm not trying to kill him. I'm trying to make sure he doesn't hit his head. But if your character is worried about him hitting his head, then you're not in character. You're not doing your job. So that's why there's different departments. Let me come in there with stunts. And, you know, there's so many things that can go wrong. My job is safety. Your job is the character. And, you know, if the right kind of training came about, then you could probably do my job and I could do yours. But right now, these are the departments that we're in today. Let's do our jobs and let's work as a team to make this character come alive, you know? And so, you know, when you talk about, like, you know, going on to set and trying to keep a good head about myself, and for me, I'm just, you know, I just know that there is so much riding on stunts specifically that, you know, somebody could die, I could hurt myself, I could destroy equipment, I could do any of that kind of stuff. So I need to keep my emotions in check and make sure that I am keeping safety as my utmost. I mean, obviously the performance is there, but, like, you know, the safety of everybody being able to walk away and not damage anything, I mean, it is hugely important for any stunt person to keep in mind, I think.
You know, coming myself from a creative background as well, I've had maybe 35 of some of the greatest stunt performers, if not stunt choreographers, on this show here. And that is the first time I've ever heard that analogy given about, the difference between a performance and action, and like the stunt choreography, the stunt work itself. And you're 100% right. I feel a little stupid for never thinking about it. I actually never thought about it that way, but that was incredibly insightful. You know, because you go ahead.
No, I said thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's just widely important. I try to tell as many people as I can about that, especially in the new performers and also actors, because especially nowadays with, you know, I think it started with Keanu Reeves, like really training hard with 87-11 to make John Wick. And, you know, I have a huge amount of respect for that. And people, you know, should be able to do their own stunts to a certain degree. I just, you know, but, you know, the really big things that could possibly hurt somebody, I mean, at the very worst case scenario, say, you know, say an actor hurts himself, and maybe it's not even their fault. Maybe they're in a fight scene, but if somebody accidentally cuts their face, all of a sudden, right, now you have, you know, 20, 30, maybe hundreds of people who are out of a job until your face heals. I mean, you know, there's right, a lot riding on an actor being healthy and safe, that if they were to hurt themselves doing something, maybe it's not even their fault, you know, it's something that they can do all the time, but it's not even their fault, and they get hurt on set, then all of a sudden everybody's out of a job, you know? So there's a lot right, riding on it, and not just their safety, but, you know, people's livelihoods.
but you're also making, you know, a hell of a lot of sense when you say, you know, as an actor, and I've never been an actor. I'm a writer, director, and executive producer myself. I have zero desire to act ever. I mean, I have a face for radio, which is why we're not Skyping this, you know what I mean? Which is exactly why we're not Skyping this conversation right now. But you're 100% correct that, you know, an actor's job is to be in the moment, to be fully intent and sincere about their action. And yes, you're right. In that fight, they want to kill that person. I mean, that's their desire. That's their feeling. Like they're fighting for their lives. And you're 100% correct that a stunt person can, or a stunt performer can easily come in there and go like, okay, I can take away that emotional content for you and make it look fantastic. And then you come back in and give them that emotion again.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, as a director myself, you know, I think it's very important that, you know, actors should be able to do whatever they want to do in the safest portion of the action possible. I mean, if they can do a certain amount of the action themselves, great. I mean, that's awesome. But at the same time, if there is a aspect of it where, you know, they have to be in charge of somebody else's safety when their character in the story isn't worried about that person's safety, then yeah, I mean, it's not helping anybody to keep them in there and have them, you know, keep both of these hats on when their job is to be this character who is trying to kill people or trying to, right, you know, protect themselves in a certain way, you know? So, yeah, right. I mean, it just makes the sense to me. I am an actor, you know, and for me, if I were to get like a really, really, really meaty role, with a lot of action in it, I mean, I would have a stunt double myself. I mean, I'm not too proud to do that because, I mean, what am I there for? Am I there to be the character or am I there to do the action?
Right.
And I know that it can seem like you need to do both, but for the most part, I mean, if it's a very dangerous stunt, put somebody else in there that doesn't have to worry about the lines and doesn't have to worry about the emotions and just has to fall off of a building and make sure that, you know, the other person that's falling with them doesn't break their neck. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, this is what I've always loved about you. And this is why I wanted to have you on the show, is that you're incredibly insightful. You're very, very smart. And, you know, you stick your hands into every pie, you know, writer, director, producer, stunt choreographer, stunt performer, you know, professional martial artist and what have you. So you have done an incredible amount of work, and really, I would say a short amount of time, because you're not by any means old. So, you know, it's very awesome to hear some, and I mean that in the biblical term, it's very awesome to hear somebody come up with some brand new content, I'll be honest with you. Brand new content, brand new honesties, brand new ways of seeing things. It's just, you've always been an amazing person, man.
I appreciate that. You make my head super big right now.
No, you've earned it. I wouldn't say deserve it, but you've definitely earned it. So let's go back into your resume here. So what happened with Bad in the Sun? So you and I both know Aaron Shankey and the family, what have you. How did that relationship start there?
I was doing some other project, and then I got a call from Aaron and saying that one of his friends had found me, I think maybe on social media or something like that, and thought that I would be a really good Goku for, because he wanted to do Goku versus Superman for his show Superpower Beatdown on YouTube. And that never materialized, because once we started getting into it, it really started becoming very apparent that there would need to be wire work, and in order to get the kind of in-air fighting that is in there, take a lot of special effects that he wasn't ready for yet. And it was just too big of a idea to shoot on where he was with that. So at that point, so we kind of cooled off on that for a while. And then later on, his friend Alex Kellerman wrote a short piece where Scorpion jumps out of the television and chases him through his apartment building, which is, hilarious. So Aaron hit me up. He's like, hey, I have this awesome costume for Scorpion. And, we have this short film that we want to shoot. You want to come over and do it? And I was like, yeah, it sounds like fun. So, so I went over there and we shot the thing. It turned out amazing. And while I was wearing this costume, because it was a full leather battle ready Scorpion costume that just looked beautiful. On the back, it was even signed by Ed Boon. And I guess the guy who made it, he was in Orange County, and he saw Ed Boon at something, and he was wearing the costume, and Ed Boon told him this is the best costume I've ever seen. And he actually signed the back of it. So if you look,
that's amazing.
If you look in the actual short film Scorpion versus White Ranger on the Superpower Beatdown series, you get there's a quick shot of it as I'm walking towards the girl about to kind of attack her, and you can see Edward's signature on the back of it. When we shot the other short film where I was just chasing the guy through his apartment building, I was kind of sitting in his apartment, and he has a lot of these action figures around. And I saw, it'd be kind of cool. What about having a superpower beatdown with Scorpion and the White Ranger? And he's like, yeah, maybe, and then later on, I think maybe it clicked with him again. And then he came back. He's like, yeah, actually, this is a good idea. And at the time I was working on another project called Grace and Earth One, and Alvin Singh was working on it with me. And we were kind of, good old Alvin. And, we were working on that thing and, putting fights together and whatnot. So when that happened, I asked him, we were thinking about Scorpion versus White Ranger. You think that you want to come on this with me? He's like, yeah, that sounds awesome. so I got him on board, and me and Alvin talked to Aaron, and we decided that me and Alvin were going to come up with the fight choreography for the piece. And then we came up with a bunch of ideas. We did we saw the location with Aaron, and then we kind of showed him what our choreography ideas were, and then he tweaked it here and there. And then all of a sudden we were shooting it, once we finished it, it turned out so great. And he showed it to Jason David Frank, and Jason was like, this is awesome. So he decided to put his face in it, and he decided to put his following behind it. And then it kind of just blew up from there. And I mean, I think within the first, I want to say day or two, it already had reached a million views, or maybe 3 million views. I don't know. I think
those episodes really get high really fast. It's incredible.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah. I think at that point, the episodes were obviously doing pretty well, but that one was definitely the one that really kicked off into a really high gear where the Superpower Beatdown got really popular. And then we did the Ryu versus Green Ranger one, and Jason David Frank really, like, he actually fought me in that one, like him himself. So, I think everything kind of just snowballed from there. And then, and obviously now we have the Legacy Wars, short film that we created, with Chun-Li and Ryu becoming the Ryu Ranger and everything like that. And, because Lionsgate got jumped in on that. So, I mean, it just kind of snowballed from there, I think. But, I like to think that we really took the choreography up to a different kind of martial arts level that it hadn't reached yet in that series, and that the audience really appreciated.
Right. I agree with you. I've always loved the episodes myself and gone to cons and been on the set of with Bad and the Sun for a lot of these episodes and done photography for them as well. But, these episodes are amazing episodes and something you wouldn't expect from YouTube content, especially these days.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people put that much production value anymore into the YouTube content. Everybody's trying to make a feature film, but they prove it's very obvious that there is still a viewership for this kind of content.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But you've always done a wonderful job there. So let's move on to Forever Purge, because I never watched the other Purge films, but I did watch Forever Purge. Mm-hmm. I have no idea why. Actually, I do know why. I took a date to go see the film. So,
okay, there you go.
I do know why. I remember when I was a little boy, I was 15 years old, and I took a, or I think 14 or 15, I took a date to go see Die Hard. And, I think the only mistake I ever made was taking a date to go see Do the Right Thing. I think that was the only mistake. Yeah, because it was so racially motivated, so racially like tense. Like, you walk out of that movie,
I mean, it could be a hit or miss depending on your date.
I know. Well, it was a miss. It was a miss.
Okay.
Because that person's like, I gotta think about this movie for a while. I'm like, oh God, do you really have to? Like, seriously, do you really have to think about it? It's like, damn, I made a mistake right there. But the Forever Purge, I mean, that was a really good film and a far, departure from the original films. How did you get involved in that mm-hmm. film, and how did you feel about being on that set, especially, like, I believe it's the fourth film in a series?
Right. Well, actually, I was booked on that, I booked on a lot of other, a lot of other shows that I've worked on. I was searching for my next job, and then I got a call from the stunt coordinator, and he said, "Hey, we're doing reshoots for this Purge movie, and would like to see if you're available during this time." And I said, "Yeah, that sounds like I'm available. That sounds awesome." And it turned out to work out perfectly. It's right in the middle of COVID too, so obviously we did all of the different things, but the movie was already shot though by the time I joined on. I actually did the reshoots because I guess the final fight scene inside of this like cabin that we were shooting that it took place in, they weren't quite happy with it. They wanted it to be a little bit more brutal. They wanted it to be more dynamic. So they wanted to reshoot that thing. So they rented out a studio here in LA and we just, we got through it. We can't, the stunt coordinator was really awesome that we kind of all got to put in our input with everything. And then shot the previs, got the okay from the studio, then came back and, they glued a bunch of yak hair on my face to match the actor and, put a wig on me because my hair was long at that point. And then, it stuck in there. And it's actually kind of funny because when I watched the movie, I looked and, sometimes they'll try to like cut back and forth between the actor and the stunt double, like depending on, the thing. And a lot of times I actually don't like that just because they're cutting up the action too much usually when they do that.
Right.
But
it's almost like a feature of Liam Neeson film where it's like, I love Liam Neeson. I don't want to bag on him, but one of his films.
That's from going over the fence.
Exactly. Where he's jumping over the fence and there are like 19 cuts. And I'm like, can you please just get over the fence?
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, I mean, but in that fight, though, I noticed that, like, I could definitely see it. I mean, I think it's just because I knew it was me, but, like, I can definitely see that it's me, and they didn't cut away from me either. So, like, the whole sequence in that little cabin area, yeah, they used me. So, well, I guess I must have done something right. Or maybe the other shots didn't work out. I'm not really sure.
Well, it has a lot to do with look, feeling, consistency, and what have you. I mean, as you know, but that's an amazing thing that they believe in you so much. And they input from you as well. That's a very open set where they take input from you. What do you want to do? I mean, we're about to talk about Suicide Squad, so they wouldn't do that in Suicide Squad.
Yeah, well, I mean, the coordinator that was on there, I mean, he was very much, he was just very open to everybody putting in their input. I mean, I think he did that because he trusted the team that he brought on. I mean, I don't think it was the first time I met him, but, you know, one of the main times that I worked with him was actually on Suicide Squad, and that's where he knew me and that he brought me on for that thing. And his name is Adam Hart. I mean, he wasn't the stunt coordinator for the whole movie. He was just for the reshoots.
Right.
But,
right.
Yeah, he's an amazing performer himself. And
yeah, I know Adam
Hart.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah.
Really?
Awesome guy. And since he knew me from Suicide Squad, then he knew that he needed a double for this guy. He reached out and – but yeah, he was very open. Obviously, you know, he had the final say for everything and he put the whole scene together and everything like that. But, the fact that he was open to suggestions and open to like this, that, whatever. And they're like, and if we came up with something like, hey, what about this? And he was very much into it, you know? So, I love that collaborative kind of work. I mean, it doesn't have to be that way on a set for it to be successful. I mean, I've been on plenty of sets where it wasn't collaborative at all. They're just like, this is what you're doing. Do it exactly like this. And that's
right.
Fine. If they have a vision
right.
that they want to stick to, then great. But I do love it when I do get a little bit of input just because I feel like it allows me as an artist to not just expand myself, but then also to collaborate with the other artists there, and all of us feel like we own a piece of it more at that point.
Right.
I feel.
Well, tell me about the Suicide Squad,
which is
please finish your sentence.
Oh no, I was just kind of reminds me of the idea of there's a metaphor that I like to say is like I like being the paint, but sometimes I want to be the painter, you know. And during those times, I mean, obviously I'm not the painter because he's, you know, the coordinator is the one that puts everything together. But, you know, being able to, as being part of the paint, be like, hey, what about a stroke here? What about a stroke there? I mean, I think that is highly rewarding for everybody involved.
Well, that you know, that's a great, again, that's a great metaphor. You know, going into the Suicide Squad, which is, I think, the primary reason why most of us got HBO Max, I'll be honest with you. And that movie was sincerely one of the best films I've seen in a very, very long time. And, you know, I don't want to wipe away the original Suicide Squad, but I mean, this beat it by like 1,000 degrees, where I would say like 99.9%. So, you know, how was it like working on that? I mean, you're working with gigantic stars. You're working on one of the best directors that is working today. And, you know, he's one of the very few directors that is able to jump from DC to Marvel, which you've done yourself, you know, working on, you know, Superpower Beatdown and what have you, working in the DC world and the anime world, the Marvel world. So that's what you're working on in Suicide Squad with a director and a cast like that. What does it feel like seeing your career at the very, very beginning, you know, being in Ohio and you know, training martial arts and then being in the Suicide Squad, which is, I think, the number one most watched film other than the Justice League film, Snyder Cut, watched on HBO Max.
You know, it was awesome. I love James Gunn's work on the Guardians movies and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, for me to be there, and I mean, I didn't really get to talk to him specifically, because, you know, it's such a big movie. I think that movie was like, what, $200 million or something like that. Huge sets, green screens everywhere, and then the, but also the practical sets that they, not practical, but the sets that they created were just amazing to witness. But, you know, there's so many moving parts that, you know, being there, it was very surreal in the sense that, you know, I was doing a pretty big gag there, you know, this big explosion where, I mean, there's 10 of us. And for that one specifically, I almost got injured pretty bad on it. So, you know, there was a little bit of nerves when it came to that. But I don't know. I mean, being on that set, I mean, it was really cool. That's not the first time I had been on a set with that big of a budget and that big of a cast and everything. But you know, whenever I go into those, it's very humbling to know that, like, you know, I'm just a very small piece of, like, a very huge team, you know. I wasn't one of the main doubles or anything like that, so I was only there for a couple of different sequences. Like, when the explosion happened outside of the big, it's not like a temple, I don't think, but I forget what it is. It's just a big explosion.
Oh, it's the high rise where Starro is being held.
Right, exactly, that place. And then, you know, but also I did the Margot Robbie scene where she is spinning around, shooting a bunch of people. I'm one of the guys get shot.
Oh, inside the place where
the prison.
She's with her supposed lover, right?
Right. Yeah, inside the prison, and she escapes and like is spinning around, shooting a bunch of people. I'm one of the guys that gets shot. So being part of those two sequences, you know, it was great. I mean, it was about two or three weeks of work there, but. But yeah, I mean, as much rehearsals went into it, and you know, the crew out there in Atlanta, they're all great, you know. And just, I had so many friends that were working on there too. Like it was a lot of fun, even in between shots, because you just kind of like, you know, you're just shooting it and you know, joking around with each other and talking about, you know, the families and you know, what their plans are for the next year and, you know, what the next job is and what the previous job was and that kind of stuff. I mean, it's just a lot of it, you know, as hard of a work as it was, because, you know, we did put a lot of hard work into it. You know, it was a lot of fun. I had a great time with everybody that was there, and especially being able to meet a lot of new people as well that I hadn't met before.
Right. Like Margot Robbie or Idris Elba and what have you.
Well, you know, I didn't meet Margot. I got shot by her, but, you know, I talked to her stunt double a little bit. She was on set. It's just, you know, when you're on set and these people are around, I mean, like, everybody's doing a job, you know, and part of the reason why usually they bring some people on is because we're not going to be those guys that go up there and be like, hey, can I get your autograph? I want a picture. You know, I'm not going to bother her unless, you know, and if I'm working it in the actual scene with her, like on a more intimate level, then you know, we'll probably have more of a conversation. But I'm not gonna go out of my way to, like, you know, go to the green room and find her and be like, hey, I love you in this. Let me talk to you about that.
I wouldn't think that's your personality. But you know, Haley Wright usually doubles her. Did Haley Wright work on that film?
I believe. The person the double that day was Ingrid.
Ingrid, yeah. I know her.
I can't remember
her
last name or something. But yeah, I think she was doubling her that day. But Margot, she was so good. I mean, she was a dancer, you know, previously. So she picked up on the choreography very well. You know, obviously Ingrid was you know, doing a lot of stuff as well, but you know, Margot, you know, she's one of those actors, she likes to be physical and she likes to get in the scene and do it, and especially when she's like spinning around doing that gun thing, you know, just like, you know, you could count it off like, and a one there, and a two, and a three, and a four, you know, so she was able to be like, okay, I spin here, point the gun there, you know, and she got it down really quick, and it was very impressive. She does an amazing job with her physicality.
Well, the scene that she did where she picked the lock with her toes, she did that one take with her toes, and they actually had to splice it because they almost didn't believe. I mean, they wouldn't think that the audience would believe that she can actually do that.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, well, I'm a total dork. So I watched the background, you know, because an HBO Max, it gives you like extra footage and what have you right afterwards. And he was talking about it. And I'm like, that is,
yeah,
that's nuts. Like I would never, I wouldn't expect anybody to be able to do that. But I mean, she's an incredible, you know, actress, producer, you know, creator and what have you. So it's gotta be a great pleasure to work with a human being like that.
Oh yeah. No, she was great. I mean, like I said, I didn't really have any one-on-one time with her, but from what I saw on set, I mean, she was very sweet and she picked up on everything really well and she's a hard worker. And I mean, yeah, it's being on a James Gunn set was very pleasurable just because everybody was having a great time the time, you know, no matter what day it was, how long the hours we were doing or whatever. I mean, everybody had a great attitude and was having fun. I mean, and that's the biggest thing that you can ask for on any set is just everybody's having fun. I've met some people that like they're grumpy about the film industry and like whatever. I'm just like, I don't understand how they could feel that way just because, I mean,
right.
Well, one, we're playing gossip for a living. I mean, you know, you're a professional pretender. I mean, how serious can you really be about it, you know? I mean, like,
100% right. You're lying for an existence. I mean, how bad is that of a life?
Yeah, I mean, I'm playing cops and robbers for a living. I mean, obviously I want to be serious about it because there's a lot of safety involved, so I take that very seriously. But, you know, as far as like an attitude and stuff goes, like I don't understand some people who can be angry that they're on set or like they're you know, they're kind of like mad about something, like, you know, unless it's something completely unreasonable, then I completely understand. But I mean, there are some people that just have that attitude. Maybe, and I think those are the people that, like, you know, we had talked about before, that, you know, maybe they got into it thinking that they liked it, but then found out later that it's not really something that they really like that much. You know,
go ahead and finish your story. Mm-hmm.
Oh no! It was just that, you know, somebody that thought they found their calling, but then later on finds out that it's the last thing that they like to do. So.
you mean like meeting somebody, falling in love, and then immediately going like, did I just make a mistake?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, the regrets. Yeah, I remember my acting teacher when I first came. I did a Meisner program for 3 years when I first came to Los Angeles.
Oh, Meisner.
When he said,
nice.
Yeah, one thing he said was like, this industry is a very demanding and unforgiving mistress.
Right.
I mean, I understand why, you know, now being in a while, I understand why a lot of people have a hard time in their relationships because, you know, it's long hours, and especially if you're traveling, you have to be away. And it can be grueling, you know, but at the same time, like, you know, those practical things aside, I mean, it is so much fun that you just are so compelled to give up all of your time for it just because of how much fun and how rewarding it is when you're, you know, when everything's all said and done. So, I mean, one of those things, I guess. Hello? Did I lose you?
Yeah. No, we're right here.
I mean, I don't know. I think that it's a lot of fun being in the film industry. You know, I get older and eventually I'm going to want to have a family and whatnot of my own, I can see how it could be pretty difficult to figure out the work-life balance, especially since, you know, these projects, they only last for a couple of months or maybe years at the most. And then you're done. So, you know, everybody has a very, a lot of pressure to, you know, make things, get things done when you're on the set and when you're doing it. And it's not like money is, you know, unlimited for, you know, some of these projects, it can seem like there's money unlimited, but at the same time, it's just, you know, everything has to happen at a certain time and under a certain budget because there are investors that do want their money back eventually. So,
right.
You know, have fun, but also make sure you do a good job. Yeah.
Well, we're quickly running out of time. I'm looking forward to seeing you have a family and children so we can have another conversation about how you're juggling those, you know, that world itself. But let's go on to quickly. What is your next project that you're working on? What can we look forward to?
I actually was just a villain on the show NCIS Hawaii that will be airing a two-part episode in a couple of weeks. I'd have to take a look, but it's episodes 12 and 13 on the show. I think they're coming up here pretty soon, either at the end of January, early February.
Right.
That one should be pretty cool. I got to film out in Hawaii, which is always amazing. Right. And the crew is awesome. It's the first season of that show, but we'll see how people like my character.
You seem to have a real connection with the NCIS world.
Well, NCIS, before this, I did work on the flagship NCIS show. I was a victim that was found in a barrel for one of the shows, and then just a random goon in another one. This is the first time that I've been cast as like a character though. The one that I found in a barrel, I was a character. They find me dead at the very beginning of the episode. So,
I was a character, but I was in a coma. I mean, that's not a big deal, right?
Yeah, right. So, that's going to be coming out. But personally, though, I just finished a screenplay that I'm pretty excited about. I've been getting some really great coverage on it with different kinds. There's these different sites like We Screenplay and Short Scripts and that kind of stuff where you can pay to get coverage on your films, which I like to do because a lot of times if I give it to a friend, even if it's like a friend that's like, quote unquote, no BS. There's always still there something they're trying to keep my life in perspective. They're trying to keep, everything in perspective. I do like the somewhat anonymous notes that I can pay for just because sometimes I feel like there's like no punches, withheld. And some of the coverage I've been getting has been really great, for this piece. It's a short sci-fi feature. I would like to be able to, direct and star in it myself. And I wrote it specifically to be very, very small budget. Even though it's a science fiction, it all takes place in one location. The log line is a man practices for a upcoming date with his dream girl by using simulations that are indistinguishable from reality, and through the process, slowly loses his mind. So I think it's very current because, we have things about the metaverse and also, virtual reality and it deals with social media. It deals a little bit with cryptocurrencies. It deals with, masculinity and it deals, and the different pitfalls that, that comes with, and also misogyny, manipulation and love versus lust. I mean, it deals with a lot of things that, I think every person has struggled with in their life, and I feel like it kind of speaks to that while keeping it in a near future science fiction world of something that is very possible that we could do. I mean, the whole idea, it's called simulation, and it's based off of the theory about simulations. It's kind of like the thing with Matrix is that we all live in a simulation, and the whole idea is that, we once we create these simulations that are indistinguishable from reality, which is we're coming very close to, then the simulations with the people within those simulations can make their own simulations. And then so if you're really creating these worlds, then chances are that we actually live in a simulation, just because what is the chances that we live in the one base reality, right? So if you're creating simulations and then those simulations can create simulations, then there are literally billions of simulations out there. So, and there can only be one base reality. So if you're a betting man, then what are the chances that you're in the one base reality versus all the simulations that you wouldn't be able to know that you're in if you're in it?
Right. Yep. Well, if you believe no, I mean, listen, if you believe in anything in quantum mechanics or quantum physics, then it all makes sense to you. I mean, it's all based on that perspective. A lot of people who've almost died or had close to death connections. And I have had one myself. When you wake up from that experience, you do believe that you shifted reality, that you were in mm-hmm. one reality at that moment, and then the experiment or the experience that you went through agitated the atoms around you so much, or maybe you died and you shifted reality. So, I mean, you know, hey, listen, to the people who are listening, I'm not crazy. just type that in YouTube and you'll find that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of near-death experienced human beings who've experienced that one thing, that when they've died, which I did, when you died and then you wake up, you feel like you were living a brand new life, which is why a lot of people have euphoria. So I understand exactly what you're talking about. I understand this new ideal of the Matrix. I don't think it's far-fetched from what I'm talking about, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, no, I think that's just where we're going. I mean, Facebook just changed their name to Meta, right? And the metaverse is becoming a thing. And, you know, a lot of people think that cryptocurrencies is just about money, but really cryptocurrencies is about owning part of the network. You know, Web 1.0 was, you know, going to a page and just reading whatever's on there. Web 2.0 was that you can create a blog and create your own pages, right? You can make something on a network, but still a centralized network. And then Web 3.0, which is cryptocurrency, is about owning a piece of that network, right? So it's not now that you're not just putting your website on the Google servers, but you're actually owning a piece of the Google network, but not Google,
right?
But other networks that are now created, you know? And that's a very big thing that a lot of people, I don't think, understand completely, that it says it's in its nascency right now. And, you know, moving forward, I think that I really wanted to write a story. The reason why I wrote it is because I wanted to write a story that kind of captures, you know, what effects it's going to have on our own personalities and the way
right.
that we deal with other people, and how we can slowly kind of make ourselves go crazy like we have with social media already, because
right.
we're in a, not only in the future, in this kind of future that I'm writing about, it's not just a little world that you've created for yourself on your Instagram or your Facebook or whatever, but now you're actually transporting yourself into that world. It's
right.
not on a screen anymore, but it's actually all around you, at least perceivably all around you, because your mind is jacked into the system, right?
Right.
So, I think there's a lot of pitfalls that we're going to have to navigate as a society and as individuals. You know, I think a lot of it is going to be individually, because these feedback loops that we're seeing right now with a lot of misinformation and things that are on, you know, on either side of the aisle, whatever your politics are, you know, there's misinformation everywhere. And a lot of it's intentional, you know, maybe from like state actors and whatnot too. So, and that's going to only get worse just because information is so much more freely available. So as
right.
that happens, you know, how are we going to cope with that? Because as a layman, I mean, as a regular person, you're not going to be privy to all the information. You're not going to be able to filter out all the misinformation like perfectly. There's no way anybody can. And then when you're creating these little networks within yourself, like say, like you create a simulation that you control completely, then how are you going to protect yourself from yourself?
Right.
You know, so
can we get a title
a very important
with
topic
the cell is?
It's called Simulation. Yeah. And, I think it's going to be pretty good. I know the covers I've been getting is really nice. I actually, like I said, I sent in for coverage from this one, and there's an ex-executive that, you know, they don't tell you who the people are, but they give you their background of who they are, you know? And
right.
I was trying to get, you know, him to tear it apart, and then he, you know, gave me back, like, a whole bunch of notes just saying, like, don't change anything, just make it now. I was like, okay.
Well, that's a nice thing. Yeah, that's
and
very
I even
nice.
Sent him another one of my scripts. I even sent him another one of my scripts to, like, see if maybe he's just, like, a very complimentary dude. And the other one he tore apart. Like, he's just like, no, this is wrong. You need to do this, whatever, you know. But, yeah, I mean, so – and that's not the only – he's not the only person, obviously. I don't know if it was a he or she, actually. It could have been a woman, too. But, you know, I've gotten a lot of other people reading it, and they're just like, yeah, this is a really, really really cool story. And I think the main thing, too, is that especially in the current, like, pandemic setting that we have with the film industry, I mean, it's a one location. It's a very small cast, very minimal special effects, even though it's a science fiction, and very dialogue. And there's no action at all. I didn't make an action movie. It's a straight science fiction dialogue thriller kind of movie. And so I could really shoot this on a very shoestring budget. And the main thing for me is that I don't mind doing that. I mean, I want to make my first feature, but on the other hand, if I am able to make it bigger and bring in some heavier people that might be able to help me with distribution or something like that, I mean, all the more reason to get it out there, because I think that it also has a lot of messages in it that are pertinent to our society today.
That's awesome. I'm looking forward to seeing that. You know,
I can send it to you if you ever want to read it. So.
No, I want to read it. Send it to me right after this. I absolutely 100% want to read this. We're about to close out right now. I mean, I really do appreciate you also sending your film. You know, when we saw each other at the Chinese Theater, you also sent me that film early on, and asked my opinion. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, that's always a great thing when people, you know, it's always an honor when people send you those kind of things and ask your opinion, because people can be brutal, brutal, and a lot of it can come straight from ego and competition. Where they're like, you know, I don't like it because, you know, it somehow infringes on my, you know, my ego. And I would change this. But some people would just be honest, be like, you know, like, this wasn't really consistent, that I really don't get where you're. I've had some of the greatest people. And unfortunately, one of the most consistent thing people have said to me was, I don't get what you're trying to say. And that, and that really, it really broke my heart, but it really made me change as a writer when I was very, very young, from being somebody who wrote a diary. So that's basically what I was writing, which is a diary, which is what I could understand, to something that a mass audience could understand.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the great thing about, you know, sharing your information with other people, not being afraid they can steal it. Cause quite honestly, nobody can do what you do. Nobody can create what you can create, and even if you give them the gray notes of what you're doing, they can't do what you can do.
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody's different for sure. Yeah, I mean, I think I realized that really early on too, because there's a lot of people as performers, they start thinking like, oh, I have all this competition because, you know, there's so many people in the industry, and they want to. It's like, unless somebody looks exactly like you, talks like you, you know, the exact same genetic makeup as you, and, you know, says the lines exactly the same way, and has all the same life experiences as you, like, there's nobody that can be you. So, and with film, I mean, if it's reflecting, you know, reality, then there's going to be, you know, all sorts of people in those realities, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, being a performer helped me early on to kind of be okay with just being like, well, you know, I don't mind sharing. I want to get the input, and you know, anybody that wants is willing to take a look, I'm willing to listen, and you know, I'll take what they say to heart, obviously, but it's not going to change how I think or about it. I might just, you know, again, take the best from everybody and then just see what resonates with me, and then make it my own.
Well, before we go, I want to talk to you a little bit about your TikTok account, which a lot of stunt people, a lot of performers have got into, and a lot of people on the other side are afraid to get into. It was interesting to go into one of your posts, which, you know, I always get like a high response count, but, you know, where somebody goes, I was like, this is great work. And they're like, this isn't him. This isn't him. And I didn't respond because, like, you're an idiot. Of course it's him, but I didn't respond. But I thought it was very amusing that, you know, it's TikTok. It's a brand new way of communicating. I mean, I wouldn't say a brand new way of communicating, but it is the feature before the new feature, right? You know, like in 5 years from now, nobody's going to be talking about TikTok. Somebody's going to be talking about like Mi'kmaq. And TikTok's going to be like the new Instagram. You know what I mean? It's just constantly going to move forward. What brought you over to TikTok? And were there any fears or kind of like trepidations?
To be honest, my girlfriend's really into TikTok. Like, she spends probably too much time on it. she really likes watching it. And they're really funny, you know. I'm like, I am a little bit weary just because I have heard some, like, weird things about, like who owns TikTok and all that kind of stuff. But on the other end of it, though, like, as an entertainer, I mean, my life is pretty public. I mean, obviously there's a lot of stuff I keep off of social media. But for the most part, I mean, like, I live in the public eye. The work that I do is the public, and I'm okay with it. You know, I don't find that to be bad at all. And I mostly deal with Instagram and Facebook, just because I think maybe it's just the era that I'm from. TikTok, like, if I find something that's kind of snappy and quick and maybe funny or something like that, then I'll put it on there. But I don't post to it very religiously. I don't really know actually what is the best times to post and all that kind of stuff either. So I'm still kind of figuring all that out.
I post at 11 a.m. every morning. But you have like Tekla Herzegova on there, and you have like Haley Wright's on there, and, you know, Amanda's on there, some of the greatest, other than like Garrett Warren.
They're much more prolific than I am. I put my hat off to them because the stuff that they're putting out is awesome. But, you know, all the other people out there, like, because a lot of them, they're very acrobatic, so they have a lot of stuff to show off all the time. I'm not an acrobatic person. Like, I never was a guy that did a lot of flips and all that kind of stuff. So, I sometimes feel a bit of a disadvantage in a certain respect. But on the other end of it, though, for me, it's just like, I don't really see my social media as something that I do see it as a tool in some ways, but for the most part, I just kind of use it as a video diary for myself, a picture video diary. Because a lot of stuff I put on there, you know, I always tell people that film is my favorite hobby as well as my profession, you know? So I love doing what I do. And, a lot of it, you know, if I put it on there, I like to scroll through sometimes and just look at the stuff like, oh yeah, I did that. And it's just like being able to scroll through all my memories of some of my favorite things that I've done in my entire life, you know?
So, well, I think both.
It's a lot of fun for me to do.
Yeah, it is. Obviously, you know who Yoshi is, you know. I love watching, Yoshi, you know, he does his TikToks without a shirt on. And he like breaks an apple in half. You know, I laugh every single time. And they're like, there's like 100 women on the comments going like, can you have my baby, please? And like, he's doing it.
Yeah.
And he's doing like, you know, I mean, he kills me. I mean, he murders my soul because he never trained traditional martial arts. He's naturally like skilled. And it's like, can you please stop? Can you please stop this junk? I mean, it's not like he doesn't train his things back now and doesn't work extremely hard, but he's naturally the way he is. Like, oh God, stop, please. But yeah, he's got a huge TikTok following as well.
Well, and he's such a nice guy too. I mean, I kind of came up with him around the same time at least. And yeah, I mean, he always has a smile on his face. He's very accommodating to, you know, his friends and he likes keeping his fans in mind. And I mean, I don't know. I have a lot of respect for the guy. He really has made a name for himself internationally, and he's done a really good job at all of it. And, I don't know. I mean, I think it's against my Midwestern sensibilities to post a lot of like, you know, shirtless photos and stuff like that. Not that I'm against it. I don't think that anybody should be ashamed of that or like whatever. But for me personally, I feel self-conscious maybe. I don't know. Like, I don't think that I have a bad body or anything like that. I'll post like nice looking pictures or whatever, but, you know, really putting my body out there a lot other than like maybe, you know, martial arts kind of stuff feels awkward for me. I mean, I'll still do it every once in a while, but it still does feel a bit awkward for me. And even, you know, I've talked to this a couple times with like my girlfriend and, you know, whatever about, you know, say if like there was a sex scene in a movie or something like that, and I was like, I most likely wouldn't do those parts. I mean, if it was a really great story and the sex scene itself really made the story, you know, there was such an impact to it. You know, I might consider it, but for the most part, it's not something that I feel comfortable doing. You know, I think it's just maybe coming from, like I said, you know, like my Midwestern sensibilities are just, you know, I don't know. It was always one of those things, like, one, never boast about yourself. You know, don't talk well about yourself, and just make sure that you know you're humble and that you keep your head down, work hard, and that kind of stuff, you know. And I think that I've kind of stuck with that a lot. I think, you know, maybe some people would disagree looking from my social media. Like, some people think I might be bragging too much sometimes, but I mean, for me, it's like, whenever I post anything, I always try to make it very much like, this is what I did, not like, you know, like trying to hype it up so much. Where it's just like, this is what I did, you judge it, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I have a lot of respect for those guys, because they have different kinds of personalities and things that are working for them so well, and different kinds of skills that are working for them amazingly. And sometimes I'm jealous because, like, I can't do any of that stuff. But on the other hand, I'm like, well, I have my own things. I can do the table.
I've always loved Yoshi. Yoshi and I have worked together several times. We've been friends for many, many, many years, and I really appreciate his personality. But, you know, it was really a pleasure having you on. You know, it's my honor to know you, and I think of you as a friend, and it's great to know you. You're an excellent personality and somebody incredibly passionate about what they do. There are very few people in my existence, in my life, that when they say they're going to do something, I believe they're going to do something. So when you say you're going to do something, I know for a fact it's going to be done. So, you know, I mean, I contacted you about the show and you're on literally a day later. So I asked, you know, a band to be on the show, like some nebulous band out of Utah, and then they totally kept me in red. And it didn't even contact me back. And I'm like, you know, it's always the nicest people. It's always the most successful people. It's always the people that have the most drive that are the nicest. And I think that really counts. You're really a part of that genre, really part of that world of incredibly nice people, incredibly fortunate people, incredibly giving people that are incredibly skilled, give a lot. And people adore you for that. So as we close out this show, how can people contact you? I know you were talking about Instagram and TikTok. So what are your handles on both those applications?
Well, Instagram, it's at Peter Jang Official, and it's the same on TikTok, at Peter Jang Official. I try to keep it easy. I also have a website. It's my production company. www.simplicity.pictures. There's no .com at the end of it that some people get confused about. Simplicity.pictures. And then in there, there's also tabs that go with my acting work, my stunt work, my directing, my writing, screen, you know, different kind of things. It has links to my screenplays. I'm on the International Screenwriters Association website. I was one of their top 25 of 2019, and also one of their emerging screenwriters competitions for my screenplay year. So I have screenplays on there. I'm on Coverfly for my screenplays as well. But yeah, I mean, I think the most direct way of getting to me would probably be through my Instagram at Peter Jang Official, or through my website, simplicity.pictures.
That's excellent. Well, we're looking forward to everything you do. I'm looking forward to reading that script as well. But we look forward to everything you do. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show, a real honor. And we appreciate your insight. I think a lot of people have learned a lot of things that were, quite honestly, brand new. Because we've done many, many shows. And, you know, we have a pretty, I think, a decent audience. And they've heard a lot of people speak. But really, you've given a fresh take on a lot of these things. So we really appreciate you.
I appreciate you, Steve. And you've been a great friend, and I'm glad to know you all these years.
Thank you very much, my friend. All right, we're going to give you a clap as we leave you, my friend. All right, it was great having you on. God bless. And we're going to talk about you behind your back. All right, my friend. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good one.
Wouldn't that be a great... Wouldn't that be great to have that? All right, boys and girls, that was an excellent episode, wasn't it? Peter Jang is quite the personality, is he not? Intelligent, charismatic, hardworking. You know, people trust and love him. And that's something to say. All the times that I've met him, all the years that I've known him, he's always been very consistent in his personality, in his temperament, in the way he sees things, at least from my perspective, and the way he sees friendship. It was a real great honor and pleasure to have Peter Jang on there from Ohio, training martial arts, to San Diego State. Let's not make that mistake, right? Learning a field that he's not even into anymore. To being a stunt choreographer, a stunt performer, a writer, a director, a producer. That's quite a human being. An actor, by the way. He has his finger in every pie. He has his toes in every river. That shows to you why people love working with him. Why an 18-hour day with him is fantastic. And doesn't allow for fault. Nobody's perfect, but I don't think we're expecting that from human beings. From the time that I've known him before to time now, I've known nobody different. He's always been the same person. Creative, courageous, strong, and forthright. That's something to admire. And I think admire is the greatest word to describe Peter Jang. He's somebody to admire. Great insight today. Great thoughts on how to perceive stunt work. I hope the actors out there that are listening understand where he's coming from. I do think it comes from a martial art background to understand the passion of an actor and how you need to separate that into the stunt performer who can separate themselves from that so nobody gets hurt and allows consistency within action. We look forward to his future work, his screenplay, the new film that he's trying to make. We want to support him all the way. All of you out there, thank you for listening today. We really appreciate you being here from the United States to Canada to Germany, from Alaska to Russia to Greece to Chile, Peru, Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, the Kiwi Nation. I appreciate you all. In this time of great discontent of the pandemic that, honestly, we can't escape right now, and I cannot not talk about it, remember to host one another, remember to respect the fact that you're able to live, that you're able to breathe, and for the film industry that Peter Jang is involved in, that it's able to survive this great deal in our life. Thank God we all have work and family and life and people. Hold your family close. Love one another. And if any time in your life, be honest and be true. You see all these people quitting their jobs. That should be called the honesty section of our existence, where you take a good look at life and you're like, you know, I'm going to live it to the nth degree. We thank Peter Jang for being on our show today. Great friend, great person. It's an honor to have him on. And thank you to all of you for listening today. Have a blessed day, and I'll see you next time. My name is Steve Peter. Thank you for listening to Central Radio. An amazing week.